Currently, the video is on my stomach. Do you want that? All right, good morning, everybody. First, I really would like to thank the lab for inviting me here today to share my work with you and and my thoughts and work that I've been working on the last years. But what I really appreciated is, and what I'd like and I look forward to, is your feedback and learning from each other. Today, I'll be looking at enactment and also how that works in sign language grammar. I'd like to share two aspects with you today. First, I'd like to share some of my master's research work that I did on enactment. I was looking at the frequency of use of enactment within a sign language, if it's used minimally or at an extensive rate. And I was also looking at Langue des Signes Québécoise, LSQ, looking at L1 users of LSQ and L2 users of LSQ. And I want to then compare that with their spoken language. When looking at sign language grammars, and actually looking at it in a generative point of view, I want to look at both points of view, from generative grammar point of view in theory and from a cognitive point of view. So in English, it's enactement. In French, it's tour de RC. And this is the sign that I'll be using. But I'll get more into that in a minute. And here are some examples in LSQ. There are many different signs for enactment. There's constructive action. There's this sign. There's different ones. But I believe that it is a person or personage that you are putting all over you and then putting it away, so I'm going to use the sign that I just showed you. So the translation is there underneath, but there it says, oh, she loves to help him. Oh, Paul told me that he would be happy to be able to help her. And so the difference with the first one is more of a centered body, and then the second was we're using more of a role shift or that enactment. And if you look at the bird's point of view, you can see that she is linking the left to the right and using the verb and transferring the verb for verb agreement. But if you see on the with role shift or with enactment, you see how that changes and how the localization changes and how the grammar then changes and the strategy. So you see the eye contact is maintained and you see the head and body is in neutral position on the one hand. And then with the enactment, you see that the eye contact is broken off and that the head and body reposition itself and that it takes on many different types of roles or shifts. And there are many different types of shifts available. So this is what you can imagine when we're talking about enactment. And now when we're looking at the notion of gestures, Kendon actually proposed, in 1980 in McNeil, and this was some of the work based on their work that I want to share with you. And this is a continuum that Kendon proposed. Looking at gesture, and then gesture has been replaced by words, so the nonverbal, and then to pantomime, and then to language. And on the one hand, on the very beginning of the continuum, there's words, and there's linguistic properties, and it becomes conventionalized. In the beginning, of course, there's no words. There's not a very clear linguistic properties, and it's not conventionalized yet. So you can see how this changes in the continuum. But there's one problem with this continuum, and as we see, this is pantomime. They say that pantomime leads then to the linguistic properties. I don't know about that part so much, but what I am interested in is the continuum at whole. I just showed you the example of enactment. These examples here. So this type of enactment, I call it a full or complete enactment. Because Paul, she fully becomes Paul. Her whole body is involved. She is not herself anymore whatsoever. And the minute she shifts, the signs that she's signing, the lexicon, that is also of Paul. This type of enactment, I call a partial enactment, because they're partially the other character and partially still themselves, the narrator. So here's an example. In English or French, you can pick, but this is it in LSQ. So you can see the two roles, the one that's when she's very cold, and then when she switches to walking. This means walking. In LSQ, this is the hand shape. But when she says froid, when she says cold, the gesture part of it was just being cold. So it's not the lexicon. But then when she actually uses the lexical sign for cold, that's when she's herself. So that's why it's a half enactment. So it's have both full enactment and partial enactment. So I'll be referring to these two terms throughout my talk. So now I'd like to talk about the frequency of enactment structures and share with you what I found in my master's research. Like I said, I wanted to look at the amount of role shift or enactment that was used within a sign language. And so I looked at three different groups. I first looked at deaf LSQ signers, users that were native LSQ, so L1 signers. Then I looked at oral deaf people who then later on learned LSQ. So they were born and raised learning spoken French and written French, and then they learned LSQ as an L2. And then we looked at the third group, which is ASL users, so they're deaf, ASL native sign language users, who then are learning LSQ as a second language. So first I looked at the L1 LSQ users, and then I looked at the two different other groups of L2 LSQ users. And as you notice, there's a difference between who are native signers and who aren't. So we have the LSQ native signers and the ASL native signers. But the middle group, as you see, they are deaf and they've learned LSQ, but they were raised with spoken French. So this is my findings. It was a very small sample. As you can see, I only had three people, participants per group. What I did was I showed them an active video. They looked at the video, and then they retold the video. And I said nothing about the use of enactment whatsoever. So they signed four different examples. And therefore, I got 12 different samples from each group, and then that was my database. And then in total, I had 36 videos to look at. The different types of enactment is you could use it for a split second, or you can stay in an enactment role for a very long period of time, and anything in between is possible. So what I did was I actually separated the data further into short periods of enactment roles and long periods of enactment. I wanted to see if there was any difference in the two, but I didn't find any difference. So I'd like to just quickly show you my findings in this graph. You can see, so the blue people are, the blue is that they used enactment. Green is when they then did not use enactment. The first group is the L1 LSQ group. They definitely had a higher rate of using enactment. And interesting enough, the L2 users of LSQ both had a lower rate of using enactment in the enactment grammar structure. So even the ASL native signers used less enactment when they were signing in LSQ. And I was actually shocked. I was like, they are native ASL American Sign Language users. Why do they not keep using this when they sign in LSQ? So I'd like to share my hypothesis with you, my hypotheses. When thinking of the ASL native users, I thought what would happen is that they would be inspired by the amount of enactment they use in ASL, that they would then transfer over into their LSQ. This is what I thought would happen. I also thought that maybe the sign and the motor gestures are found in enactment and they are shared by both sign languages. Therefore, the ASL users demonstrate their LSQ skills. Maybe they think, okay, I don't want to use my ASL skills. When I sign in LSQ, I'll be more lexical driven, so I can show off that I actually know LSQ, and I will decrease the amount of enactment features. These are my two hypotheses. So I thought, perhaps there's less enactment used in ASL, so I added a third study. I had L1 ASL native users, and I looked at how much enactment was in their sign language. So I reproduced the data, and then I added native ASL users and looked at their ASL and how much enactment, the enactment structure was used in their ASL. And it was 100% copied. The amount of enactment used in LSQ for the L1 users and enactment for the ASL L1 users were shockingly identical, which was great to see. However, you do notice that these ASL native signers, when they were signing in LSQ, the amount of embodiment of enactment structures, they were reduced. However, I obviously had to reject my first hypothesis because ASL also uses just as much enactment as a feature in their sign language. So then I wanted to test the second hypothesis, saying that maybe they felt that enactment structure was gesture-like and or more, was less grammatical. So if they were asked to sign in LSQ, that they had to then minimize the amount of using enactment. I have not been able to test this further yet, but this is my hypothesis. But I do notice that there is a lot of gesture within the sign languages. Everyone following so far? Great. So looking at enactment and that structure, I wanted to further delve into the uses and possibilities of enactment and how it was used. Want to look at enactment as a grammatical element in sign languages. So I had to take a step back, and actually I wanted to take a look at what the literature has said until now. Most of the literature is from generative perspectives. So I was curious how they explained enactment within the generative perspective. One article that really got me thinking was from Lilo Martin in 1995. She saw that the point of view, she saw it as a point of view of an utterance predicate. So that when you are actually doing an enactment, you are using a verb. These type of verbs, you're an expression, to express yourself. So in English, it would be like, mom's like, I'm busy. And this is how it would be then denoted. And so the point of view, it was so, and then they said that enactment was done in the POV section, in the verb phrase. So the verb phrase, when you're pointing to yourself, that's not really yourself, you're actually pointed to the other character. So even though the sign is a direct index to yourself, you're actually indicating to that second character, to the point of view character. So I'm Daz, and then when I become the mom, do the role shift. You can see I take that enactment position on. Another article is from Joseph Queer. So Lilo Martin actually saw what was being produced, and he said that this is not just an expression, it's actually much wider than point of view. For example, from Lis, from Italian Sign Language, Fanzucchi, he saw that when you have this type of example, the enactment was when during donate. So the sentence is, when Gianni arrives, he will give you the book as a present. So the coming and the book, there's no role shift. So this was seen as a PVO. And the explanation for this was that the PVO is used to manifest non-manual features morphologically and the indexical shift. And because that indexical shift will then spread down the tree. But I was still missing something. I was missing the non-manual information. And they said the way you can explain that is when you create that shift, it'll take on the positioning, but I'm missing the attitude and the expression and the other grammatical features. So this is what has been written to now, and I took it on, and it gave me some food for thought. And then I looked at Kremer's work. When you look at the generative perspective, the one issue is that it's difficult to look at what happens simultaneously. When you have a negation, you can have the verb, but the verb becomes negated. And so I had a proposal in LSQ. You can sign this expression here. Read? No. Saying he did not read it. But you'd sign read and then no. And if you look at the phonology and the syntax structure, they have to all be combined at the same time. So I have an idea on how to circumvent this issue, because the theory blocks this possible way to then formally express this. Looking at the VP, I wanted to find a way how to get around this. The negation is not only attached, not always attached to the actual lexicon. Sometimes it can be disembodied. And that depends on the enactment feature that you use. And I'll give you an example here. You can have this type of reaction that he could not believe what he was reading in the letter. So it's not that he wasn't reading, it was that he couldn't believe it, but you're still seeing the negation marker. I'll show you an example now. So I'll show you the two again side by side to exemplify the different type of negation. So the first one was he did not read it. So the first one you saw, it was linked to the VP. Definitely it was a negation to the VP. The second one is not, the negation has nothing to do with a negation on the VP, but it is completely showing attitude. The person did read it, but the negation marker was showing disbelief. So for the first example, it works well to attach it to the VP, but for the second example, it doesn't work. And that's because the disbelief attitude is being shown simultaneously with the lexicon. So now I decide to look at it in a cognitive perspective. Yesterday we had some great discussions about taking on a cognitive perspective, and so this will link in nicely there. But Langacker, from 1991, he was sharing how everyday actions and repetitive actions are then embodied. Like tying your shoelace. Anyone, when you first try and tie your shoelace, it takes an extreme amount of effort. As you see, it becomes all of your body, and then it becomes routine. Similarly with language, we have language that becomes embodied and signed languages. And because we are producing sign language from this embodied cognitive perspective, there's a lot of overlap, but it also transfers from one side to the other. So what I'm interested in is gesture as a simulated action by Hostetter and Alibali. If you look at the motor cortex, the primary motor cortex, and the premotor cortex, those are activated when we're signing. If I'm looking at someone doing an action, let's say someone biking, if I just see someone biking, we also know that's also activated within our motor cortex. I am not actually biking, but just by seeing, just visually seeing someone biking, that will activate my core motor cortex. We had that discussion yesterday. So linking this to iconicity and embodiment, I was looking at examples of embodiment dissonance. There's one research in 2002. This was on spoken languages. They asked a group of people to say, open the drawer or close the drawer. Just say the words. Just say the words open. And then say the words close. And then they asked them to say the words close the drawer when opening it and open the drawer when closing it. And this caused then the dissonance, the embodied dissonance, that the lexicon and it actually affected their motor skills and to enact opening and closing the drawer. So there was actually a time lapse. So this is from American Sign Language, and actually looked at an LSQ, and the same occurred. The sign one is, we looked at the verb, and cognitively, and or the pronoun or an object. So if you have an object in space, but if you have the verb is the process, the verb is the action. You have a beginning and an end. So the sign for chair is chair. That's the sign. And in LSQ and in ASL, it's the same. But the verb is to sit. You see there's a beginning and an end. So the sign for the object and the sign for the verb is the same lexical sign. You can see it's the same sign, but the way you produce it is different. And you can sit in different forms. You can have the action and the motion of sitting within the sign. When you sign chair, there's only one way to sign chair. It's an object, it's inanimate, and it stays the same. You have this sign as well for sitting. But that is the difference between those two lexical items, where it makes a difference if it's an object or a verb. But so looking at the embodiment abilities in these verbs, that's what I want to further look at. So what happens when you then use the enactment strategy? What happens cognitively? And what happens when we use enactment with space blending? So Liddell and Metzger, and also Liddell in 98, had written extensively on this. And he felt that when we also look at real space, we look at the here and now, but cognitively, we also have our surrogate space. And most often, we want to actually present what's happening in that surrogate space. So we are actually drawing upon both of these abilities, or places, both the surrogate space and the real space, to provide a blended space. So knowing that cognitively we have these two different possible places, this is where we can retrieve the language from. But if I go back to the continuum that I showed you in the beginning, from gesture to pantomime, I was trying to marry the two. And when I looked at enactment and pantomime, one person said pantomime is actually strongly attached to your motor abilities, your motor cortex. Just like when you are drinking a glass, when you're picking up something. Those are everyday motor skills that you use. And that can also become lexicalized. So she says, yes, I was talking with my friend, and then she was really, really coughing, so I got her a glass of water, I gave it to her, and she drank it. But if you look at this in pantomime, Martinez in 2008, I just want to show you this example for you to compare. So they're both using this gesture or this sign of drinking. But what is different? What do you notice that is very different between the two? I think within the pantomime, the actual holding of the glass, picking it up, and the way they're drinking it, and you actually see the Adam's apple bulge, That doesn't have, that's pantomime. You don't see this whatsoever within the signed sample. The signed sample is drawing much more on the So if we look at the, so I'm looking at my friend up in the subordinate, what was it called again? The other space. Surrogate, thank you. So the action is happening then and there, but she's drawing upon her surrogate space. Whereas I feel the pantomime is relying much more on that real space. And that's also real space. So when I'm looking at enactment and comparing that to pantomime and the continuum, yesterday we were talking about brushing your teeth, and you can use either a handling or an entity classifier. When we're looking at enactment, it's usually done with a very simple gesture or a simple sign, and these gestures do become conventionalized. And then Wilcox showed how these constructed action become a lexical item. So, but when it's a very complex constructed action, for example, this, that is quite expressive and expanded upon, that stays constructed action or enactment. That will never become a lexicalized item. But short embodied enactment pieces can become conventionalized and then become lexical items, like drink. I had mentioned Langacker earlier, and I looked at his work in regards to cognitive grammar. And when we looked at semantics, he put semantics is then also related to, of course, phonology, the phonological pole. So, for example, in French, you have the word arbre, tree. But the concept of tree, or but just the letter A-R-B-E, those then are the semantic pole and the phonological pole then come together to create meaning. And then you have the symbolic unit, and the symbolic unit is then both the semantic and the phonology together. And what Langacker wanted to get at was when you have a sentence, the boy went and then screams, but the word "ah" also has linguistic meaning. People want to call screaming a gesture. But when you scream, that's a symbol in itself. We all have put meaning to that scream. So Ferreira and Johnston felt that this was actually a symbolic unit, a linguistic unit, but they felt that role shift was only for gestures, that you could not call words. You could not then label that for words. Oh, I only have 7 minutes left. Okay. So now I want to look at gestures and grammar. What's interesting is Rathman and Mather actually was looking at how this works with verbs. Their idea is based on Jack and Dolph, and they worked it out further. Liddell was explaining how a verb has all these linguistic features. But the locus cannot be put into a nice fitted linguistic feature. There are a gazillion loci possible. We know that linguistics, we want to have them in a nice knit form. It's not possible to mention every single localization, so that's where they put that under gestures. But Rathman felt that this model wasn't working, and so what they said is when you want to express this. They wanted to see, well, how this happens conceptually. What are the conceptual structures that happen within cognitively? So when you have it on a syntax level or a phonological level, and then you have the expression, the actual, be it in a spoken language or a sign language. But that it takes these steps, it comes from a conceptual structure to a phonological structure to an expression. But I think we need to split out, actually, this gesture space, because we can't just lump everything under gesture, because if you have the verb agreement of give, for example, but that does not take into consideration the loci. And the way we can see that the information packing hypothesis then can really help us say that there's much more information, that the linguistic information, the gestural information is then packed together. So I looked at this and it was exciting, but then I got to a problem here, the conceptual structures. We do know that there's a continuum from gesture to then a lexicalized item, and there's everything in between. And it's not just constructive action or just a lexical item, but that when you, again, the sign for give, the lexicalized item for give. But what do we do in between steps? And where do we then split it out? Is it happen in the beginning, in the middle, or the end? So these are just my thoughts. But further on, Rathman and Mater do talk about the enactment part goes into the last box here, and this is an example here. So this clip of the lexical item is walk, but the way she is walking like this, using it, and the movement and expansion and the role shift, it is all packed into one. And you can walk in all these different ways. And it's constantly in flux, depending on, of course, what you want to say. But it doesn't make sense to me that it would split off and then come back together again. But again, Langacker says, well, you can actually formally explain this using complex symbolic units. That you have two units, symbolic units, that come together. So you can explain this by the gesture and the lexicon that are combined together, working together to perform one symbolic unit. So I like the explanation of Rathman, but I wasn't completely happy that it would split up and then come back together. For me, this type of a theory works better for what I see happening within the language. I can share much more. This makes me very, very excited and very passionate about it, but I will conclude. So in conclusion, looking at the continuum from embodiment, gesture, pantomime to language, we do realize now within linguistics today that we cannot ignore these gestures and or signs, so that grammar is definitely a part of linguistics. We can't just throw away half of the language. We have to have a lot of attention for the linguistics and grammar and the formal aspects today, and I do believe that it's extremely important now to look at the whole picture. So we need to look at both the linguistic structures and the gestural structures, make sure that iconicity is also being looked at, and I see it every day in all languages that they are not one can live without the other, and we need to respect that they both exist equally. And that's all. I'd love to hear your thoughts. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Carlo. Hello, everyone. My name is Annika. You can see it here. This is my sign name. I'm very happy to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me to this workshop. And I have to thank Death a lot for setting the stage like this, because then I can go easily and slowly through my slides and a lot of things pop up again. So thank you very much for this perspective and all these things. So let me start by saying that I will also look at the same phenomena, right? Multiple perspectives that appear at the same time. Well, and I called it a systematic chaos. And as Des already said, that you find so many things, a variety of things, that you try to aim at how can you combine this in a model or a theoretical approach. And I'll give you a lot of data. I'm an experimental, empirical person, right? So I'm coming from the data. I look at the data and then draw my conclusions from there. So I'll guide you through this, and you will see that a lot of things will pop up again. Okay, so I'll give you a theoretical background, a little bit of terminology. Well, I can say a lot of terminology, but I'm trying to clarify what I call enactment or action role shift or constructed action. We'll see what it means. We're actually talking about the same things, and this is even more important than to clarify terminology so that we see and that we can understand each other, especially in such an interdisciplinary workshop that we have here, which I really enjoyed up to now. Okay, I'm giving you a little bit about methodology, and then I'm diving into these multiple perspectives. That's called partial enactment, and I say that it needs to be disentangled even more, right? Because parts can be multiple parts. Okay. Simultaneity is important, as we all know, and then I'll also get a little bit into the role of the narrator and present an analysis at the end. So here we go. I'm calling like the umbrella term role shift, and role shift slash enactment, as we have seen or heard before. Words, thoughts, emotional states, everything as an action can be reproduced, and it can be real persons, and it can be fictional characters, and at some point, some object as well, which become personified, right? Personified. It's important to note, and this is where the term constructed action or constructed dialogue or something comes from, that every time you repeat something, it's a sort of construction from your own perspective, right? So you cannot originally copy what has been said. This is from the spoken language theory on quotation. Okay, the whole thing triggers a context shift, and this is what we have already seen about, for example, point of view predicates with Diane Lillo-Martin, and the point of view operator with Joseph Kerr, that they think about that is an instantiation of a context shift that happens. I list the whole terminology. You can read this later if you want to have the slides. And this is what has been called perspective shift, role shift. So we find all shifted reference with Engbert Peterson. Elisabeth has started with that. So there are a lot of terms calling this role shifting element differently. Constructed dialogue versus constructed action is the most popular, I think, right? We're talking about enactment here as well. But what I would like to point out is that this distinction between constructed action and constructed dialogue has an umbrella term called constructed action, which is not really convenient, because if you have an umbrella term and a subdivision that is called the same, you're getting confused, right? So this is why I'd like to disentangle this and say the whole thing that we're talking about is a role shift, because you shift, and then you differentiate the different shifts. And this is why, in the end, we come to something like a quotation role shift, where you quote actual words or thoughts, and then an action role shift, which I'd like to then maybe address similarly than enactment, as enactment, right? You can define enactment broader and or narrower, but this is what I mean by action role shift, similarly to constructed action or enactment, okay? So you can see these different kind of terminologies. So I like to present a continuum as well, but not the Kenyon's continuum. So you all know this by now, which is perfect. So we have this in our back head of the head. What I like to point out is that why I call it role shift is that you have on the one end of the continuum, like a pure quotation role shift without any, let me call it enactment, right? So you can have a role shift, shifting your body and then giving the thoughts or the ideas or the words of a person without having any facial expressions, without moving your body in a certain way. And this is why this is not constructed action. This is no action. This is not enactment. This is one end of the continuum. And I have to say, this is very rare in sign languages, right? Most of the deaf people tell me, well, we never use this like this. We always have action in our quotation or in our action role shifts. Yes, okay, that's fine. But in principle, it's possible. And this is why this end of the continuum is there. And then you go through poor action role shift, where you really have only gestural action / pantomime. We already seen the distinction here. Yeah, that there's a difference. So I would not say this is pantomime at the end of the continuum because we are within a language. Yeah? And in between, you can mix those. You can have different perspectives. You can have quotation. You can have lexical items in those things. Okay? So this is what I'd like to set the stage for my talk, that you all know what we're talking about when I repeat my terminology or our terminology here. I have to say that Nina Christine Pensitz, which was on the slide at the beginning, is one of my co-authors of a paper that comes out this year, that she has done a lot of work on this. It's my data from the fables, but then we have worked together, and it's always teamwork. As you know, most of our work is teamwork, right? So I really have to appreciate her work as well. Yeah. Okay. So I can go quickly through this because most of you know, and if not, then now, because Daz has prepared that nicely. We have quotation role shift, right? And you can have a quotation, report linguistic stuff. What are you doing? You move your body. Change your eye gaze. We already seen this. We change the head position. We change the upper part of the body. I call this grammatical markers. Right? If you quote someone and you move, this person has not moved, right? He has not moved his body when he said that or when he did that back then, what you quote. So these markers are not copying, imitating any character. It's how you signal that you move from one context to the other. I'd like to put down the mic and do this, copying my pre-presentation. This shows nicely, right, what you do with the body. You switch locations, you take over the role with a certain grammatical marking, okay? The interesting part is that facial expressions sometimes are enough for action role shift to indicate that you are in another role, right? So here we could discuss what these facial expressions are doing, right? For role shift and quotation, this is usually not enough if you see the pure end of the scale. So I call these grammatical markers and these gestural markers, but it's not as fixed because we see later for the action role shift that this can be enough. And these grammatical markers, of course, do not have to appear all of them at the same time. You can also indicate with one eye gaze shift that you are in the role shift. Okay, if you like try to design it a little bit more visually, you have a grammar part and you have a gesture part, and the grammar part is the grammatical markers, but you can of course imitate the way of signing, etc. Right? So this can be added, obviously. But you can also have this only. Right? This is what I try to say. Yeah? And again, we have heard that before. So if you have a sentence and then you quote someone, then the I is not the I anymore. You are in a role of a different person, and then you switch. And the pronouns are interpreted according to the new context, to the old context, right? Okay. So there are some reference to literature on spoken languages where you can also have this, where you can have the I as a pronoun interpreted not as the I of the actual speaker, but another speaker in another time. I'll show you an example. We have seen before that Giuseppe has criticized a pure point of view predicate. Giuseppe has criticized a point of view predicate because some of the elements, for example, local or temporal indexicals, may or may not shift. Yeah? There's the pronouns that usually have to shift, but some elements may or may not shift. And I'll show you an example, meaning on Thursday, Marie and Kim met, and she told him that she would like to go to the movies on, and then you can see Friday or Saturday because it actually says tomorrow. But how are you interpreting tomorrow? The tomorrow of now or the tomorrow of the quoted utterance, right? And sign languages may be different in respect with respect to whether it's ambiguous or not. So some have said that for French sign language, usually you have the interpretation, the actual interpretation, like direct interpretation, direct quotation, that you shouldn't mix them, right? In Germany, you can, in DGS, you can mix, both in German and in DGS. It's ambiguous. So in this tomorrow can be interpreted as the tomorrow of yesterday or the tomorrow of today, right? And it's ambiguous in that way. You might have noticed that the role shift already starts at the verb, right? This is also an interesting spreading phenomenon of non-manual features or grammatical markers. Can they spread on the verb of saying or not, if it's there? This is really clear DGS. Of course, you will see examples later on where it can be without an overt verb, where it can be shifting from one perspective into the other and going back and forth very quickly. Okay. Another comparison that has been made is because it's not direct speech, role shift is not direct speech and not indirect speech or indirect discourse. It is a mixture of both. That you can compare it to something like free indirect discourse. You might have known this notion. It means, for example, in literature, you have something like a mixture between those appearances. Are you the speaker or the narrator, or are you in the character perspective already? And you can see that with certain linguistic elements. So you can see that with temporal information, and you can see it with something like damn, right? Pronouns are back in the one direction, and then you have some swear words and elements that tell you now you are closer to the character and you are in the role. And this mixing of narrator perspective and character perspective, that is similar to what we find in role shift. This is summing up, right? Indirect discourse, direct discourse. We find something like modal particles, dialectal or colloquial style, and then then you feel more attached to the character. This is like a stylistic element in text writing. And so it's a mixture. That's it. It's Nina. She's very good in that. So here, I'd like to point at another perspective. Why those elements, temporal or local indexicals, you don't have to read through this, right? I go step by step, and if you want to have the slides, I can share them with you, no worries. Interestingly, why can certain elements shift and sometimes they don't need to shift? And there is a different perspectives and different theories going on. And one is a lexical perspective, also based on work in spoken languages from Regine Eckhardt. Eckhardt, I can write down. Right, she said that some lexical elements have the intrinsic meaning that they are ambiguous in terms of context, right? And you can say, looking at sign languages, that some elements, like for example in DGS, today or now, they go downwards and even point to the actual floor. So this means that it might be possible that some signs that have an iconic local direction are more likely to be interpreted in the direct way, even though if you are in a role shift, if you point to today, it's the today of this floor or this actual context. And this is why some elements are more likely to shift and some elements are not as likely to shift, right? If you have a temporal scale, the temporal scale above your shoulder, this is not as likely, like this scale above your shoulder, the temporal scale from yesterday to tomorrow and the future, this is not as iconic to the actual context. So it might be that you can interpret it more likely to the actual context or the context before. But something like here and today seems to be more likely interpreted as here, right? So Paris right now. This is summing up these approaches for this kind of mixing behavior that you find within this world shift, right? You have free indirect discourse, you have context shifts, and it says that usually in context shifts, the shift together constraint is at play, so all pronouns, all local and temporal indexicals need to shift, right? But you also find some lexical-driven or, for example, pragmatical-driven exceptions. So there's one theory out there of Emma Meyer. So this was nice. Emma Meyer from the Netherlands that has like an unquotation account, right? Saying that pragmatic reasons drive some holds to go through the general shift together constraints. Okay, and now I'll present like one little piece of what I'm suggesting here, that role shift behaves similar as a, like agreement, right? So it's a point of view operator, it's a context shift. We go with the theoretical approaches there, but it has some certain amount of agreement features. So when you look at the facial expression, the eye gaze, the body and the head, and you look at this nice sign that I just copied, right? You see there are two locations and you can go from one location to the other to give like an agreement verb, for example. And the body seems to agree with the action, with the sign of the former context. So you go with the body to the location where the actual signer now takes over the role of the other person, saying something yesterday or doing something yesterday or whatever. And then the head position in the eye is directed to the addressee of the former situation, right? So there you have locations that the body is agreeing with. Let's put it like this. And my arguments for that these are grammatical markers is that the actual person doesn't really move the body like this. It's just a marking of now I'm in the other role. Right? And of course, the body shift and the eye gaze, etc., are longer than on a verb, right? An agreement verb. But in the actual context, it seems like an agreement with some features, local features, in quotation world shift. Okay, So coming to action role shift. I think I'll go, okay. I'll go through this quickly because this is what we know, right? It's gestural elements, and then we have reproduction of emotional states and mannerisms, and this is what action role shift is like. Similar drawing. You have a grammar part, even though now the gesture part is stronger, right? On this end of the continuum. And you have something like classifiers that you're using within action role shift, which are taken from the grammar, right? No hearing gesture person is doing something like falling down, maybe at least, but not, for example, walking with two fingers, right? If you have a certain animal that needs the two-finger classifier. Handling classifiers are, and that we have seen, a different thing because they are between gestures and grammar. You don't really know at some point, is it a grammatical element or a gestural element? And there it was really nice to see how the pantomime person is doing it because he's doing it differently, right? It's not conventionalized. It's not the same, so you can grasp a glass from the top or have the hand below, which does not happen in handling classifiers in sign language. So you gave me some more arguments to push this into the grammatical section. Yeah? Okay. What I'd really like to stress is that action role shift, even though it's very gestural, and even you have the enactment features and all these things happening, that the sign space is followed. You don't walk out of your sign space, right? You usually don't use your legs. And also referent representation within action role shift is restricted and strongly tied to the language restrictions, to the language and grammar part. Okay, I said that. It's for you later to read. It's the same thing that I said. And quickly, I'll show you some data, like 15 minutes, that will lead you through some examples. The Aesop fables, we copied them. Like this is the Echo project from the Netherlands. These are fables, are little stories that work well. They have few reference in there. They are nicely told that you can memorize them good, well. And then after memorizing it from the text vanishes, and then the signers can just repeat as much as they want till they think this is a nice fable, right? So this is what we've done before. We have a data set of different fables, five signers, two female and three male. We annotated, so back then, I have to say, we needed two cameras. Now you have very high quality camera where you zoom in. You don't really actually need two cameras. But back then we had one camera for the body and one camera for the face and then synchronized them in Elan with the annotation program. And then we had different tiers annotating them and it looked like this. Most of you know. If not, these are synchronized videos, and then we have glosses, left hand, right hand, we have the eyes, we have the mouth, we have the head, the body, and everything is annotated. And if you see this, I back then annotated also the eye blinks, counting eye blinks and when do eye blinks occur. This was a very time-consuming and interesting evaluation, but it gave some nice results on eye blinks. Okay, here are some of the sites also popping up a little bit in your presentation. Blended spaces, we have partitionable zones, calling body partitioning. And the interesting thing is that you say that it's partial or half that or half that, but we find even three perspectives at the same time. I'll show you an example. Now, for this, this graph doesn't include the three, but I'll show you. And this is the narrator, and you have quotation wall shift and action wall shift, and of course the dotted line in between, because it's the continuum that I was showing you, right? And what I'm interested in today is looking at the combination of narrator in action wall shift. And And you can use this different perspective with different parts of your body. In sign language, you can have the hand and the body as one character, and then the other hand as another character, or you can have the body versus both hands, right? So you have different combinations. Here, only the two, right? You can imagine then having different, more options if you have three elements or three characters, including the narrator. So if you look at the narrator, you can have different things that pop up during action role shift. For example, you can describe a sign. I'll just pick up the example again of scream. If in action role shift someone screamed and you want to show this, then it's not very visible, especially in sign language, if you just stand there and do, right? So then the narrator adds a screaming lexical item to explain what actually is the action. But the person did not say I scream, or something like, and not I scream as well. So you can reactivate the reference. Yeah? You can reactivate the reference. And you can add information. So all these functions can be done. I'm interested in the attitudinal part, because when you said before, the attitudinal part, the attitudinal comments, right? Because in action role shift, is it possible to get the narrator's attitude? We saw an example at some point with a negation, disbelief, showing disbelief, but this was not the narrator. It was the character that reads in a disbelief. So it's really hard to find examples, if any, where this additional comment can be. Usually this additional comment appears at the end of the action role shift or the end of the quotation role shift. But here I would be happy to go into more detail. If you have examples where you have something like, she said, I'm going to marry Tim, and she's happy about it, but you think it's not a good decision, then you can have like a skeptical facial expression of the narrator or something. So these examples, I don't have examples in like natural data right now. So we can discuss this, but this should be in principle possible if you can separate the face from the hands, etc. Okay, and this is just like a little add-on. Kissy Cormier and people have done a lot of on action role shift, calling it constructed action. And they say that if you reactivate a reference in the middle of a constructed action, it's probably a mistake because you forgot to introduce this. But we find this a lot. So we find action role shift, then the noun, as a reactivation of the reference, and then getting back into the action role shift. And you can clearly see the difference. So why not analyzing it as like a matrix clause within the action role shift? Right? Syntactically, you could think of this, because this is usually, it's unusual in sign language to have like a clause within an embedded clause, but that is something to consider. I'll show you an example. Here are the glasses. It's like suddenly a mouse. Well, you see. And then you have a narrator in action role shift. Yeah, I think I'll go directly to the picture that's even bigger. Can you see this? This is the mouse, pure action role shift, right? And here you have the mouse in the right hand. You have climbing of the mouse, which is a classifier, which is a grammatical element by the narrator. And you have the body is the lion. Also the nose is the lion, but the facial expression is the mouse. Right? So you have those three perspectives at the same time. And I definitely agree with the results of the L2 learners, right? Because this is very complex and has a combination that is usually learned late by any second language learner, right? And it doesn't really surprise me that even ASL native signers have difficulties in do action role shift in a different language, Because it's a language, and you go step by step in a learning process, right? So even though it's gestural, it shows it's not as gestural. It's really complex, and it has grammatical elements in there. Okay, this is the screaming. Okay, so it's about the wolf and the boy that screams to the village people that the wolf is there. Most of you know these stories probably, right? So it's screaming, telling them that there's a wolf coming. And of course he's not screaming, "I scream." He screams and the narrator gives this additional information. So this is the narrator and this of course is the quote. Yeah. So it switches quite quickly. But we have the option of this description of the narrator. One last example. This example also involves a scream. Similarly, not the same sign, a different sign. And then a classifier construction, which I like very much because this I have not found in any L2 data. Because usually those people, they have one step after the other and not include different perspectives like this. I'll show you the video. Well, screaming part is clear, I guess. But I would like to point out this. So here you have a mass class, like a mass coming, approaching someone. And the mass is approaching the boy. So the body is the boy, but the facial expression is of the people that come. Right? And usually L2 learners, what they do is they first sign the people, and then they sign the mass this direction outward, and then towards the boy. Having facial expression and body partitioned like this usually does not happen in L2 learners at a certain stage. Let me put it like this. Of course, every L2 learner can reach this stage, right? But looking at the students, BA students from our university, this is quite a complex phenomenon as well. Okay, I'll give you some numbers. Interestingly, if you look at them, and also referring back to numbers, in 20 to 40% of all action role shifts found in the data, 20 to 40% of all the action role shifts are simultaneous. Right? So this is consistent across signers, and it's a simultaneous construction that is quite complex, right? With both grammatical elements and gestural elements intertwined. Yeah? This is just three fables. Three fables of two signers, right? But you can go through the data like this. Yeah? Okay. Ten more minutes. Yeah, that's true. Okay. Short break. And then let me just tell you about something about this theoretical approach that we found these things. We found these mixing of perspectives, right? And we also find the agreement of the body with certain elements. For example, one hand agrees with one referent and the body, the face, agrees with the other referent, right? We can see this within a context shift. The context shift remains the same, so we have this context shift analysis. But then within, we can say that some reference, some body parts, agree with different characters, right? And this works. So for quotation role shift, we can go for the loci. Yeah, we usually have the quotation loci on the right side and the quotation loci on the left side, and we have two people or three people talking to each other, and you know which one is talking to which, according to the locations. For action role shift, you need to be to broaden up a little bit. You don't really have locations all the time. As you saw with the lion and the mouse, she's standing right in the middle. She doesn't really move the body according to locations, right? She maps facial expressions, behavior, movement, and stuff like that onto different parts of the body. And this mapping and the, let's say, agreement controller can be the reference itself, the reference as signer and addressee or referent and character perspective. So what you find is with, for example, plain verbs, you have this subject agreement, body as subject in a theory by Irit Meir from Israel. I cannot really say the name without swallowing. So, so the plain verbs are represented like a body as subject. So you have plain verbs, and then the body is the subject, right? So it's an agreement relation in plain verbs in some sort. So you could say that this can be copied onto thinking of role shifting or shifting perspective with the body. Yeah? And then facial expressions suffice, but this doesn't really pose a problem because now we have like a face agreeing with a certain referent, and then you have this agreement relation. So you can broaden the agreement theory of the quotation analysis to an action role shift analysis. And then you have the two possible contexts. And then you have the parts, the simultaneous reference. You have the context shift operator, and this together can show with all the examples that I gave, that it's such a structured and systematic phenomenon that it's not as much chaos as I said before, right? It's not too much chaos, okay? And then I will show you one example of the existence of an action role shift within an action role shift. And I don't have an example of three contexts possible, but let me put this up into the workshop, and then maybe we have this as a discussion. This is the story about the hare and the turtle, and the hare mocks the turtle and laughs at the turtle because it's so slow, and the hare is the role shift, and within the role shift he imitates the turtle. So the hare, typical to the turtle, he mocks her. Oh, you, it's so funny. Typical, you walk like this, right? And then shifting back to the middle of the camera, to the camera, and then mocks the turtle in copying her, and then going back into the role of the hare, saying you're always so slow, right? This is like a context shift in a context shift, like a action role shift within an action role shift. So you can embed it in a certain way because you copy what he did, and when he copied, then you can copy. I don't know how far it goes because to pragmatic constraints, but in principle, yeah, that would work. Okay, so whether this is another context shift because it's one context and shifting to the other, but it's an action role shift within an action role shift. So far, I would go. So summing up, that means that we can find systematic things happening in action role shift slash enactment, even though it's very broad and the movement, for example, changes, right? We had this little question about walking. How is walking in LSQ? Like this, yeah? So of course you can walk like this, but you can, I would say, morphologically change the way of walking, and then the body adds up how the walking has been done, do facial expressions. This doesn't need to go around, and you don't really have two units as you said, right? It can be a morphological marking of the walking, of the movement, because the movement in the prosodic model of plantari is like a free modifying feature. So this is, in principle, not necessary for me, from my perspective, so this is interesting how these perspectives come together, doesn't need to be two separate units, right? So you can have like a modification of the movement. And the same, I would say, applies here. So you have discourse reference, right? And semantically, you have a context shift on this side, but how it will be visualized depends on whether you have non-manuals only to quote, to show the quotation role shift, and then you have agreement, embody a subject as like a secondary thing, because you can do it, and then the R loci are the relevant triggers here, or you have the R loci. Yeah. Or you have like R loci here, but the agreement part is not as strong in terms of R loci, but in terms of the subject and the reference, right? So you take over the body as subject agreement, and then you represent the reference like this. And so that means that action role shift and quotation role shift, of course, are separate, but they are a continuum, and they can be unified below one theoretical approach. Yeah. Okay, so I still have 2 minutes, so I step over the mercy and go just quickly to the additional analysis, or let's say additional data that I'm currently looking at. Also, is native versus non-native narration, but these are both signers, deaf signers, one native signer, one non-native signer, and then I'm really happy to hear more about the L2 data and look at the BA students I'm looking at right now, so how this gets together. But you see that Van Randau, she's an interpreter of DGS, Van Randau. Her name is Stella. And she looks at constructed action / action role shift / enactment, and how L2 learners have difficulties with that. Right? And you can tell from the complexity that I've showed you, and also if I show you these two videos, you see that it's fluent signing, but you obviously see the difference in how it is told. I'll just show you the videos. We have the 2 minutes left, and I can show you the videos. Okay. I'm not going through the end. I stop in between. I'm not going through the end of the videos. I stop in between. No, I don't stop. This is the same. I just go. Okay. So, of course, you can say that there are also two styles at play, right? So one is telling it more quickly and as a story, and one is really having it like a theoretical approach, saying it, telling it to kids, for example, right? No, deaf non-native. So she acquired EJS by the age of six. Before six, she learned orally, and then from six on, she learned DGS. That's what I said. It's not a late learner. It's a DGS signer, very well signing. But you can still prosodically see a difference, even if you raise the style, right? You can see those difference, and then even more the difference probably in your L2 signers. Okay, so this is what I mean by if you have the complexity in this system, right? This complexity cannot be covered by L2 learners in that quick manner or in that complex constructing manner. So my plea for more disentangled views and also a grammatical approach, grammatical analysis of these things, even though at first glance it looks very, very broad and with a lot of variety and gestural parts in. Because gesture is nice and is great, and it works well in sign language. I'm not denying gesture because I have this gestural part and it's strong in action world shift. But I would like to see how gesture is integrated in the grammar and where is the drawing line, right? Okay, I think with that, I'd like to stop and thank you very much for your attention. Thank you.